from the studios of KPCW in Park City. It's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment, our relationships with, and impacts upon it. I'm Kyle McGuire, sitting in for host Nell Larson and Chris Cherniak this week as we continue remodeling here at KPCW. Today will be a rebroadcast of two interviews of favorites of Chris and Nell's conducted in the past couple of years. The first interview today is with Jim Williams about his book Path of the Puma, The Remarkable Resilience of the Mountain Lion. This interview aired on September 11th, 2018. During a time when most wild animals are expecting decline in the face of development and climate change, the mountain lion has experienced an expansion of population. What's behind this expansion? What makes this cat so resilient and resourceful? And what can wildlife managers learn from them about the web biodiversity that is in desperate and in need of protection? And then in this, Chris and Nell will speak with Jim Williams about that book. And in the second half of the show, we'll have a replay of an interview with Ed Barbier. He is a professor of economics at Colorado State University about his book, The Water Paradox, Why There Will Never Be Enough Water and How to Avoid the Coming Crisis. He argues that there is a growing crisis with respect to water supply and demand, and that this crisis is as much of a failure of proper water management by governments and municipalities that is a result of physical scarcity and overuse. That interview originally aired on February 12th, 2019. Our relationship with and impacts upon the environment, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. We'll have the first interview with Jim Williams after.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the second half of the show today is Jim Williams, the author of Path of the Puma. Jim is an award-winning wildlife biologist who's been working with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks for over 27 years and is just about to release this book through Patagonia. So, Jim, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, you've been studying these creatures for 27 years. What is it about the cougar or the puma that draws you to them?
They're really a fascinating species, and they're one of the most efficient predators on planet Earth, and they're one of the most widely distributed large carnivores on the planet. And here in Montana and the Northern Rockies, along with bears and wolves, they're a lot of public interest in them as well, and I've always been fascinated by those species.
It certainly is one of those species that captures the public's attention, I think, for better or worse. So during a time when most wild animals are kind of seeing threats and declines, you talk about how the mountain lion is in some areas seeing kind of a resurgence in population. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, really, it's all about tolerance. You know, how much room can we as society make for large carnivores and for a species like a mountain lion? And if you think about it and roll the clock back a little bit, throughout the West and throughout the country, deer and elk have rebounded primarily at the interest and request of hunters through time. And when you build that prey base, that opens the door for the carnivores that will utilize it. And in this case, it's mountain lions. And we've seen a steady increase in population since the 70s. And granted, not everywhere and not across the board, but overall, particularly in North America, they're reclaiming ground they haven't been in for years.
And so do they cover pretty much all 50 states? Are they present in all 50 states?
No. That's a great question. So mountain lions are pretty much confined to the western United States and Canada and western North America, and with the exception of Florida. And what's changing is there are these stepping stone island mountain ranges like the Black Hills or the Snowies or the Judas, the Bighorns in Wyoming. You know, there's always been lions there, but densities at any given time have increased, and juvenile males and juvenile females disperse. They leave their natal areas where they were born to find new territories, new habitats to live in when their natal area is full. So they're moving along these river corridors to the east, and sometimes they're tolerated, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they get hit by a car, sometimes they make it. But that's what's going on in the central Rockies. It's a little bit different up north.
What about outside of the U.S.? How are these populations looking?
So that's another great question. So down where, you know, mountain lions are distributed pretty much almost continuously, along with other large cats and cat species, by the way, all the way down to Patagonia, to the southern tip of Argentina and Chile. So I have, you know, over the years here in western Montana, we have all these large carnivores and large ungulates and moose, sheep, and goat, and a lot of kind of high-profile species. So we've hosted lots of scientists from Chile and Argentina and gone back and forth and worked together. And their issues are remarkably similar to our issues in the West. And it's, you know, livestock depredation. Occasionally a mountain lion will prey on domestic cattle. It's tolerance. It's human safety and competition up here with hunters at times, the perceptions thereof down there. In Argentina and Chile, it's large sheep ranches and tolerance of something that can eat your livestock. And so it's remarkably similar.
So why do we need mountain lions? What role do mountain lions play in our ecosystem?
Well, mountain lions and other large carnivores across the planet have the potential to structure ecosystems from the top down at times, and then also respond to variables and factors from the bottom up. So mountain lions, deer and elk, and there's a great quote I opened one of the chapters up, and it's actually Edward Abbey's quote, you know, if you like a deer, thank a lion, essentially is what it is. A lot of these ungulate species have evolved, and adaptations represent, you know, behaviors fleeing from predators over time, thousands of years in some cases. So it's kind of this ancient dance between predator and prey, and mountain lions in many areas are the top of the food chain, particularly down in Patagonia and Chile and Argentina. Up here, of course, we have wolves and bears. You throw some other variables in, and then in Central America and Northern South America, you have jaguars, which are larger than the mountain lion. But we need these large carnivores to be, you know, part of a complete ecosystem, and we're still, as a field, you know, science is still discovering what these roles of top, large, keystone, apex carnivores represent in ecosystems.
So what kind of, you know, you mentioned that kind of collaboration with some of the folks working in South America and Chile and Argentina. What kind of lessons or management practices have you been able to share? Are there like some successes that have come out of that?
Yeah, I think, you know, frankly, both ways. It's amazing, and I write a little bit in the book about this in the second half. You know, when I walked into a room in Patagonia, Argentina, full of ranchers, you can pick them out right away. They hold themselves proud, heads high, unique dress, just like here in the cowboys in the West. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these ranches have been here for generations. You can pick them out. So what we've been able to do is talk about how to tolerate, when to eliminate a cat that gets into trouble versus preemptively killing all of the cats on a ranch, for instance. And mm-hmm. so my colleagues and friends down there have made great strides working with, they're called estancias, large ranches, the size of national parks up here, by the way, to tolerate cats. And if they can do that, you're going to affect change at almost the scale or size of a national park in the West up here. So we've shared a lot of techniques to tolerate cats, and frankly, just basic information and education. And I think the more people learn about these animals, they all care. They're all interested in these species, and it's just a matter of getting the word out.
That type of, I guess, predator control, as it's often called, is also, you know, it's also something that we deal with, of course, here in Utah and in Summit County and Wasatch County. So what are some of the techniques that, you know, are being used on the estancias?
So I think, you know, we're always going to have some livestock issues with large carnivores, bears and wolves included. you know, those are non-native species on the landscape, and these carnivores are going to take advantage of the most vulnerable and opportunistic prey. Typically, that's deer for mountain lions up here, or elk, mm-hmm. or a deer-sized animal. When we do have a problem, it's a big deal, because if you own a large ranch, you know, your livestock, you know, that's your business. So what we have done in Montana, and they've done elsewhere in the West, and we're trying to export that model down south, is rather than kill all the cats, kill the offending animal. It's unfortunate, it's regrettable, but it's not a population level impact. It's an individual cat that is focusing on livestock. The population will be fine as long as the habitat's there. So a lot of people on both continents are interested now in habitat, and that's conservation from the ground up, because if the habitat is conserved and the prey base is there, you'll have the large carnivores if we make room for them.
How much land does a typical mountain lion require, acre or square miles?
Yeah, you know, what's fascinating is the behavior of Puma concolor. That's the genus and species from the tip of South America to all the way up halfway through, you know, Alberta and British Columbia, their range. It's very similar. You know, you got home ranges around 80 square miles for a female, almost twice that for a male at times. You have densities on the landscape are similar. There's differences, but across the board, a cat's a cat's a cat. It's really quite interesting.
Wow, 80 square miles.
Yeah, potentially.
That's a huge range.
That's a big range. Yeah. So, lost my track. What about their, let's say, their annual litter or so? How much, you know, what does a mom produce or so?
So the studies I've been worked with is the average is about 2, and it can push 3. And you think about it, a kitten will stay with its mother for about a year to a year and a half. There's a pretty steep learning curve on how to take down wild prey and not get hurt. Survive, eat it, wow. Move on, and do it again. And that takes a little bit. So a kitten's going to be with their mother, you know, up to 18 months. I've had a few up to 2 years. And in most studies, that's pretty similar. There's been some really long-term groundbreaking work with new technology and satellite radios and infrared cameras in the last 10 years that have refined those statistics. But it's pretty similar.
Tell us a little bit more about some of the work that you've done here in the American West. Some of the research that you're maybe currently working on.
Yeah, my career really can be defined or summed up in one word, and it's people. So I've spent my entire, I began in the research, just kind of the traditional, you know, the hardcore radio collar science field work, which was wonderful. You get to literally live with these species when I was in graduate school and when I was a young wildlife biologist in here in Montana. But I became a wildlife program manager and ended up, you know, working with all sorts of species. And I happened to, you know, experience the recovery of wolves in the Northern Rockies. That was quite high profile and controversial. And been fortunate enough to work with some really talented grizzly bear biologists to develop our monitoring program up here in the Northern Rockies and our human conflict program. We're teaching people how to live with bears. So between mountain lions, bears, and wolves, my career really has been defined in working one-on-one in local communities, trying to deliver conservation locally. And that's not easy to do. It takes a lot of coffee with ranchers or one-on-one time with people, but it's been great. It's been really, really meaningful for me.
Do you think making those personal connections is part of the reason for the success of some of these programs?
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind. I've been so fortunate to work with some super passionate biologists in Chile and Argentina and have them come up and go down, and those relationships between, you know, biologists are a pretty small network of scientists, especially wildlife biologists in rural areas, and it's just wonderful to have those relationships and to share experiences and success stories and failures, more importantly.
How did that connection get started with, you know, Chile and Argentina and your work in South America? What was the connection?
So my first trip down was actually part of the Partners of the Americas program It started in the Kennedy administration years ago, and it paired South American countries with North American states. And Montana ended up being paired with Argentina, and they were having Puma livestock issues. And Dr. Rick Douglas was a professor at Montana Tech at the time that helped start the Montana chapter. He asked me to go down if I'd be interested, and I remember telling him, you know, my kids are little, I'm not sure about travel. But I ended up, he talked me into it, and away I went, and boy, it was life-changing. I fell in love with the people. You know, I'd heard about the landscape, the food, the wildlife, but really it's the people that are just wonderful down there. Very passionate group of biologists.
We're speaking with Jim Williams. He's the author of the new book, Path of the Puma, The Remarkable Resilience of the Mountain Lion. So, Jim, you mentioned having how important conversations with ranchers are, landowners like that. What about conversations with the general public? Because every time a mountain lion steps inside the city limits of Park City, it's front page news, and people get a little concerned.
Yes. So I actually used to live in Park City between undergraduate and graduate school, and it's a wonderful town. And I know personally and firsthand from climbing around the mountains there that you have mule deer and moose, but where there are deer, there are cats. Whether you see them or not, they probably watch you. And fortunately, 99.9% of the time, their search image is for deer or a deer-sized animal and not people. But occasionally, a young animal gets into trouble and there is a conflict with a person or a pet, and that's always probably going to be there. I think people can rest assured that 99.9% of the time they're looking for deer. That does mean, though, if you feed deer and you artificially concentrate them in your backyard up by the ski hill or out by Park Meadows, you know, if you have a bunch of deer in your backyard, you know, you're going to have what eats them as well.
Chris, you better watch out.
Well, it's funny you mention that because that's where the latest sighting was, in Park Meadows, an area of Park Meadows, in Round Valley area.
Yes.
But it is interesting that you say 99% of the time they're looking for deer, but how much percent of the time, if I'm out hiking by myself, might a cat be looking at me?
Probably more often than you realize.
Yes.
They're pretty stealthy.
Hence the name Ghost Cats.
Is
we've read,
that?
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Jim, I'm curious what was like the motivation to kind of bring all this experience and this research together into one book?
So that's a great question. When I returned from my last trip down from Chile, from this incredible movement to create new national parks in Chile by Chris Tompkins and her late husband Doug, and it was called Conservación Patagónica at the time. Now it's simply Tompkins Conservation. What those two as a couple and what Chris is now doing now is nothing short of unbelievable on planet Earth. They're taking their entire wealth and investing it into buying literally habitat aggregations or groups of ranches the size of Yosemite and larger, creating protected areas, taking down fences, restoring native wildlife, and then giving it back to the local government, to the governments of Chile and Argentina. And that's unheard of on planet Earth right now. It's just incredible. The legacy is amazing. So I got down there and was inspired by my counterpart, Christian Saucedo. He's a veterinarian and the conservation director for Chris. Just blown away by what they've done, and I really wanted to write something up and celebrate that accomplishment and help get the word out, and it just evolved into telling all the stories I had saved over the years. It was actually quite therapeutic to write the book.
give us a feel for the book. What's the I don't know, walk us through the experience of the book.
Okay. Well, when you write a book about your own career, it's relatively easy because it's firsthand, right? But as scientists, we tend to and are trained to write boring science drivel. You know, a typical peer-reviewed research paper, a study area, method, discussion. Well, I learned real quickly writing a book for non-biologists and, you know, for everyone here and abroad even. I wanted to really get that message out. You mentioned the general public. That's what I wanted to do. We fail as scientists to to write to non-scientists. And so I really wanted to do that. And I learned real quickly that is very difficult. And so I was very fortunate. Patagonia, Carla Olson, the director of books down at Patagonia, she's building this incredible recreation and conservation genre down there in a book department when people are kind of moving more toward, you know, iPhones and audio and away from hard books. Carla's building this genre, and she paired me with some brilliant editors that essentially had their literary way with me, and I had me rewrite, and they were right. I mean, to make it readable and entertaining. So that was my personal firsthand experience. Is I have a whole new profound respect for professional writers and their craft. It's just amazing how talented they are, coming from a scientist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but my book starts in, there's a little bit of personal autobiography, which, you know, is usually required, and it was kind of fun to tell. I started in San Diego and bounced around through undergrad and graduate school, but I started in Montana, and I literally talk about kind of more traditional research on these magnificent animals and what we've learned and some of the issues up here in the Northern Rockies, whether it's population management or habitat conservation, what have you, or tolerance. And then I transition down to Argentina and the amazing work done on the windy steppes of Argentina. And then I finish in Chile in the Tompkins Parks. And it's kind of a fun journey. And, you know, for a lot of folks, you know, you live in the Rockies. I live in the Rockies. We take it for granted. You know, we live in a pretty magical place, a pretty wonderful area with public lands and all these species. And the same is true with Patagonia. You know, they're pretty similar, yet wonderful places for wildlife and outdoor recreation. And it was fun to write it up and tie it all together.
We only have a few minutes left. I got one question. Of course, it'll take you like 8 minutes to answer, but but it has to do with sports hunting. Now, in the state of Utah, it's difficult to quantify the exact the number of mountain lion, let's say, in Utah. It's an estimated by the DWR as some 4,000 mountain lion in the state. And those populations have been increasing year over year, like you said, healthy populations, but also the number of permits that are being allowed for hunters to go out and hunt these cats. Limits on different sections of the states. It's not just, you know, some 1,200 or 1,500 permits or so. But those number of permits are also increasing. Put you on the spot here. What do you think about sports hunting for mountain lions?
It's actually a great question, and it applies to a lot of species. So we tend to, as biologists, and I'm sure in Utah, and well, I know colleagues down there, researchers and biologists and other Western states, we focus on populations, not individuals. So you're going to have that value. My personal value, do I think an animal should be, you know, taken and eaten or taken legally with a license and whatever means in any given state? That's a personal value, and everyone's going to vary, you know, what color do you like? But biologists are going to focus on, is the habitat there and what's the population status? And so where that gets kind of messy is, okay, if you got large private ranches in many areas in the West, most biologists are going to manage somewhat to landowner tolerance, and as they can get more acceptance for native ungulates or carnivores, they'll do that, versus in areas with large blocks of public land or wilderness where you can manage, essentially have a very natural density of large carnivores on the landscape and have it be tolerated. So it's going to vary throughout the West, but what I always tell folks, you know, when I get this question is, you know, defer to your local biologist. Most of them have graduate degrees, and they live and breathe these species. And, yeah, there's political influence, you bet. Is there landowner influence? You bet. But these biologists want to do the right thing, and it's all about populations. And the beauty of science, and this is why science is so important in research, is we now know, you know, the percentage of the population. It's easy to knock populations back. It's also easy to let them return. And what's neat about that is if you take a look and go down to Chile and Argentina, where cats were eliminated, they're Patagonia puma, a little bit larger in my mind, a little lighter colored. But we know from data up here, working with hunting seasons and population management, that we can, you know, have a population rebound in 3 to 5 years to a natural density with all their life history traits, you know, remaining the same. So we've learned a lot through hunting seasons as well. But your question is going to vary on the area in Utah and what the pressures are externally versus a hands-off approach and having a natural density. So right. It's a complicated question. It's going to vary geographically with your land ownership, is my guess.
Okay.
Well, before we let you go, we want to highlight the fact that you'll be in Utah next week, right?
Yes. I'm going to do a presentation, so I'll be out on a fun book tour, and I'm going to have a visual, probably 30 to 40 minute, take people, some of the photos and experiences and side stories that are mentioned in the book and take them out a little further and kind of bring people on a little journey visually, between Argentina and the crown of the continent here in Montana and down to Chile. And of course, sign books and answer questions, but I want to take people there visually. I live and breathe this. I love it. And it's just a special part of the world down there and up here. And they're remarkably similar, which is amazing.
And so you will be at the Patagonia store in Salt Lake on September 19th at 7 p.m.
Yes.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's really fun to hear about your experience working with these incredible animals. And we'll see you next week.
Yes.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. That was a interview from September 11th, 2018 with Jim Williams here on This Green Earth. Coming up after a word from our supporters, we'll have our second interview of the day. This interview is from February 12th, 2019 with Ed Barbier, a professor of economics at Colorado State University, about his book, The Water Paradox, here on KPCW.
Welcome to This Green Earth, the weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us by phone is our first guest. He's Edward Barbier. He's the author of The Water Paradox, the new book, Why There Will Never Be Enough Water and How to Avoid the Coming Crisis. Ed, thanks so much for joining Nell and me this morning on This Green Earth to talk about your book.
Well, thanks, Chris, for having me.
Well, let's start here. There's a lot to talk about. And like we said in our intro, water is precious, particularly out here in the western U.S., and we'll get to that in a little bit. But let's start with this. What is the paradox associated with water?
Well, the paradox is that despite all the signs, scientific and policy signs, that water is getting increasingly scarce around the world, why are we not marshaling all our human ingenuity, innovations, and incentives to alleviate this crisis?
And so what does the crisis take, let's say, the form of?
Well, first of all, what we're seeing is that about a third of the world's population, about 2.5 billion people, are already living in areas of scarcity. And that number is going to rise. By 2050, we could see half of the world and possibly half of our grain production suffer from water stress. You add on to that all the predictions for climate change, which is going to affect water supplies drastically, and then growing demands, new demands for water for population growth, economic development, and urbanization. And you can see that the crisis is going to get worse rather than better unless we start to do something about it.
Yeah, you have an interesting table titled Projected Water Stress in Countries Starting Around 2040. And some of these countries are not too small and quite important. They include places like, where you cite extreme water stress, countries like Afghanistan, Iran, Israel, Kazakhstan, Kuwait, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. These are places where you describe as under extreme water stress. Give us a definition of that term first.
Well, extreme water stress is where the increasing withdrawal of water is going to exceed the ability of water to regenerate renewed supplies. We have two sources of water: surface water, which comes from rivers, And water bodies like lakes and ponds and reservoirs. And then we also have groundwater, which is the fossilized water underground. And when you add up the total water, freshwater supplies available to these countries, the projections for increased demand is really going to outstrip those supplies. And we're going to see two things. First of all, we're going to see increasing scarcity of the water, and that's going to mean that for these countries to obtain more supplies for their growing populations and economies, it's going to cost them more and more to do so. And then the other thing we're going to see is that in many of the countries you read out are in extreme arid and semi-arid regions. Mm. We're going to see the effects of climate change start to really bite into the supplies. And you add that to the fact that these are very politically volatile mm-hmm. areas of the world, we also might start to see water figure into lots of conflicts and disputes between these countries. And that's not a good thing. So we're going to see both economic, political, and social consequences of water scarcity pretty soon.
So, you know, these lists are really interesting to look at because it's not just the developing countries or the super arid countries that are going to see water stress. The United States, where we are, of course, is in the medium to high water stress category. So what does that look like for us?
That's a great question. I mean, and that's extremely important, is that the Western United States is predominantly arid and semi-arid as well. We have a similar problem coming that many states are facing, which is that the original use of water in the Western United States, 80% of it was for agriculture, but the fastest growing demands are for urban, municipal, and industrial uses of water. Our populations and cities are growing rapidly in the West. So we also are facing the consequences of climate change and increasing frequent and more prolonged droughts. So the United States is increasingly facing the same consequences, that water scarcity is a problem that's growing, and it's going to increase with all the competing demands for water. And then the third dimension is that many citizens of the West and the United States care about the environmental conditions of the water. Recreation is a growing industry, fishing, boating, and just simply enjoyment of rivers and lakes is incredibly important to many people. So there's increasing demand to leave the water in the ecosystems that is the rivers and streams. And then finally, the point I try to make in the book is that unfortunately our policies, our institutions, and our government structures were developed in a time when water was relatively abundant, and which there weren't many people, and there wasn't much urbanization, and agriculture was the principal use of water. We need to adapt those management regimes in order to deal with scarcity, and that's the challenge moving forward.
I thought it was really interesting that, like, you know, one of the points you seem to be making is that it's not necessarily that we need to panic because there isn't enough water. It's that we're just not managing it well, and we don't have the right policies and governance in place, right?
That's absolutely right, Neil. Or we could turn this around and say, we can't do anything about climate change. We can't change the amount of water. But what we can do is manage the demand for it more, and to try to balance out these competing demands. And to do that, we do need to rethink and develop better institutions, governments, and incentives.
We're speaking with Edward Barbier. He's a professor of economics and senior scholar in the School of Global Environmental Sustainability at Colorado State University. He's also the author of the new book, The Water Paradox: Why There Will Never Be Enough Water and How to Avoid the Coming Crisis. And just to circle back or localize it, you know, we here in Park City and Summit County recognize how precious water is because it's literally foundational to our economics here, you know, mostly in the form of snow, because it drives our wintertime economy. No water in the form of snow, and our economy suffers as a result. And in the summer, not enough water in our reservoirs, per se, because we have very dry summers precipitation-wise, then we suffer. Can suffer not only recreationally, but more importantly, agriculturally. So water is indeed precious out west, and there is more and more of us putting demands on our water infrastructure. And so let's circle back then. You talk about proper management of water and the proper pricing of water. Let's talk a little bit, expand on that a little bit.
Yes, pricing is key to all of this. What you want to see is, as any commodity, and water is not excluded, gets more and more scarce, then that means that we need to pay more for the use of it. The problem we're seeing right now is that there is growing demand for water from cities and urban areas, and that's reflected in people valuing the water more. Generally, water in cities and in growing industrial uses is about $250 per cubic per acre foot, whereas in agriculture use, because it's allocated to agriculture primarily, water is used abundantly, and it's about $25 per acre foot. Now, that means that there is an incentive here to save water and to use it better if we sell some of the water that's in agriculture to the growing uses for urban and industrial use. This would do two things. First of all, it would mean that people would conserve water more because they're paying more for it. And secondly, the farmers themselves would have an incentive to save water and use it more wisely, adopt a more water-saving irrigation and other means, because water is now more valuable to them. They're able to sell it for money to the cities. Why don't we see more of this? Well, that has a lot to do with the fact that drought makes farmers reluctant to sell their water. Many of the farmers themselves may not own the water. It actually belongs to the irrigation districts, which were created by the large-scale water project. And that means that they're not allowed to sell it to non-agricultural users. If they don't sell it to another farmer, then that's the only trade they can do, is to other farmers. And then finally, it's really difficult to get water from one place to another, so we have to think carefully. If we're going to make lots of trades between farmers and cities, we have to think about the appropriate infrastructure. So water markets really work. And if they're allowed to develop, a lot of Western states are experimenting with them, and there's a lot of success that's starting to happen to take advantage of this difference in prices and to try to manage between the two uses.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. So let's talk about some examples of those successes. Who would you point to and say they're running their water market, let's say, properly?
Okay, well, one city that seems to be making some headway is Santa Fe in New Mexico, and then there's Arizona is also struggling with the same issue of managing water. And one of the things that both Arizona and Santa Fe are experimenting with is what's called water banks. And water banks are just like ordinary banks. Farmers put their excess water in this bank, and then they have the choice in the future either to withdraw the money from the pooled supply from all farmers for extra water for them in drought seasons, or alternatively, if there isn't a drought or there's excess water in the bank, it can be lent out to and temporary leased to urban and industrial users. So water banks work just like ordinary banks, just the currency is water rather than money. And that's proving successful because it takes the burden off the individual farmers' risk of drought and concerns about drought. And it also means there's more supplies of water pooled that can be delivered and sold to cities and urban areas. That's one side of the equation, is dealing with the supply of water, getting it from agriculture to growing uses. The other side of it is managing the water in cities itself. So what many cities are starting to think about in the West is what's called two-tier pricing for water and sanitation services. So what that means is that for an average small and low-income household, there would be one price of water. But if you exceed that price if you use more water than what a small household would use, then you'd pay a second higher price of water. And that would cause households and businesses to conserve on their water, because
right,
they would try and keep within with conserving amounts.
Well, here in Park City, we have a very, I would call it progressive water tier system. We actually have six tiers or blocks. And I printed it out, the fee structure, and I'll just run through some of the numbers quickly. If priced on a per 1,000 gallon basis, from 0 to 5,000 gallons, that's block one that you use, you pay $6.12 per 1,000 gallons, roughly 6/10 of a cent per gallon. As you go up in your usage between 5 and 15,000 gallons, you pay $9.81 per 1,000 gallons, so 9/10 of a cent per gallon there. And so on and so forth, all the way up to block six for someone who actually needs 55,000 gallons of water a month or whatever, they pay they'll pay roughly $28 per 1,000 or 2.8 cents. Per gallon for the water they use. This is for residential use, not commercial. Is that so? Is that a pricing system that you see that is an example of pricing water in a proper way?
That's exactly right. Now each city is going to have to decide what is the tier structure that works best for them.
Right.
But what the problem is with pricing of residential and commercial water in cities is that at the moment, across the United States, 50% of the operating costs of getting that water is paid for by the government, 50% by the customer. And then meanwhile, the investment cost, the investment in actually building the reservoirs and the pipelines and all that, all the infrastructure investment, 70% of that's paid by government. We cannot keep doing that without running into the problems of not paying enough for water scarcity. So whatever pricing scheme we come up with, and this two-tier scheme is will control use, we have to make sure that the prices themselves will help recover some of those costs, because we need to recover the cost of infrastructure and operation to reduce waste and use within the system as well. And then, of course, the other thing is that pricing does something else. It means that households will start turning off water when they don't need it. They'll start saving. We're seeing this in electricity, where we have off-peak and on-peak uses of electricity. We need to think about that with water. We also need to have programs that would encourage customers to use water-saving appliances. Again, the analogy with electricity and energy is that we have an Energy Star program where you can get rebates if you buy energy-efficient appliances. We should have the same thing for water, for showers, for toilets, for washing machines, and so forth.
So in addition to recovering, you know, those infrastructure costs that you mentioned in the pricing of water, you talk about recovering the cost of environmental damages. How do you do that? How do you even start, you know, calculating those costs and incorporating that into your water rates?
That's an excellent question now. One of the things I discuss in the book is about integrated river basin management, or at least a comprehensive river basin management. And that's where you look at the not a body of water such as a river from the standpoint of which state owns which part of it, but from the standpoint of the entire river basin. How do you manage all the water for all the uses? And one of the things that comes out from successful river basin management from around the world is that environmental concerns are incredibly important to all of this. We have to figure out, in addition to figuring out how much we want to use for agriculture, municipal, and industrial use, we want to think about how much we need to leave in the river itself so that the river is healthy and will maintain good flows in both drought conditions and in other times, and also what are the environmental uses we want to sustain on the river, whether it's for recreation, tourism, or simply maintaining a healthy river. So we have to think of the environment and in-stream water as one of the important uses, if you like, of a river. So river basin management needs to deal with all of these aspects. To do that, we have to think about what happens to the river if we don't take care of it. What are the damages? What are the values that we lose and the benefits, and who's affected? And then we also have to bring those entities, recreational groups, environmental groups to the table, along with agriculture and urban users, to involve all the stakeholders in the discussion of how to manage the river in the long run.
Yeah, well, here in Utah, you know, you're nodding now. You know what I'm going to say? Here in Utah, the river is the source, or is on the bottom of the list as far as who gets the water first.
That's right.
Fish are last. And
that's exactly right. And that's a legacy of Western law.
Yeah.
Is that, again, going back to, if you think back to, 19th century Western states, the primary concern was there was no people. How do we get people to settle here? Most of them coming out would be engaged in agriculture or ranching. So we gave the water to them, first in line, first in time. Mm. So they got the water use first. And that's why we've ended up with 80% of our water allocated to agriculture and ranching. And then, of course, as cities started to grow, we started to think about how to send water to the cities. And now, in the late 20th century and early 21st century, we're now concerned about the environment. And so it's the last allocation. But all our laws are geared towards supporting what's called the consumptive uses of water, whereas in-stream flow, the environmental, the fishes, if you like, are the last consideration. That's starting to change, but we have to think about our laws and how our institutions and incentives are going to manage that use as well.
Are there any other countries that are doing this right, that have, you know, better protected in-stream flows, or where their policies better reflect the importance of environmental water?
Well, one of the big experiments in whole river basin management is occurring in Australia on the Murray-Darling River, where for the last 30 years they decided to manage the entire river basin. And they found out five things. First of all, that a crisis is a good motivator. So they dealt with a huge drought and had to rethink their river basin management on the basis of a prolonged drought. Secondly, they decided that the river basin itself had to be the priority for jurisdiction over the individual states, and they set up institutions and government structures to think river basin-wide. Thirdly, they added in the environment as a factor. They recognized that if they didn't keep healthy flows in the rivers, then the farmers and urban areas would ultimately suffer as well. And so they started to think about, if we're going to leave water in the river, it has to be the first priority, not the last. And secondly, if we're going to manage the competing uses, we have to use water markets. And the water markets are not just between agriculture and urban, but also environmental groups and recreational groups can also buy water. If they don't think there's enough water for their activities, or they would like to preserve more of the environment, they can pay for water. And then equally, the water can be sold between agriculture and urban uses, as we talked about before.
Right. And one area I've seen over the last 20 years or so of where technology is playing an increasing role is the use of advanced treated water or wastewater to be introduced back into the community, either supplementing stream flows or used as irrigation. Where I came from in Florida and Southern California and Arizona, advanced treated wastewater is used to irrigate public green spaces, and et cetera. Or in some cases, it's being reintroduced into the groundwater and then used as a source, raw source, for drinking water systems. So technology can play a role in that market also.
Absolutely. And technology is making a huge impact on groundwater, as you mentioned, Chris, that we have better technology to assess what water is underground and how much there is, and how quickly we're using it up before it gets recharged. And that's incredibly important. It's also, technology is also helping with the trade. We can now use technology and call up the market prices for water, but also use the technology to monitor and track how much water is being transferred, how much water is available to the farmers if they sell some of it or all of it. So technology is huge. And innovations in the future will be huge. What we want to see is water-saving innovations and innovations that help monitor and deliver the services. And to do that, we need the incentives and institutions to encourage those innovations.
Well, we have just a couple of minutes left, so I want to kind of ask about your take on this. Do you feel, when you look at the future of water management and water use, do you feel optimistic? Do you feel like this is heading in a positive direction yet?
I think there's encouraging signs. When I see the developments that have occurred in recent years. So, for example, in response to its drought, California implemented some wide sweeping groundwater law changes, which are incredibly important. Up to then, groundwater was treated as a free for all, and now they have some more stringent uses. I see that river managers and those responsible for rivers are starting to understand we have to think more comprehensively about the rivers. And I see that there is growing concern and interest in trying to change our institutions to grapple with scarcity. And I think that's encouraging. I think the signs that are discouraging is a problem that I talk about in the book called water grabbing, where you have very powerful companies, some of them are international companies, that are simply coming in to all parts of the world, including the West of the United States, and buying up access to water, buying out, making bids on farmland large tracts of farmland to just basically access the water rights. And that's of concern to me. Because I think that it is one way of dealing with the crisis, but the short-term gain is matched, more than matched, by the long-term possibilities of conflicts and resentment, which I think is going to be a difficulty.
Right.
And this is, of course, occurring a lot more in poor countries are the targets of this water grabbing. And so we do need to think carefully about that.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. You've been listening to a rerun of one of Chris and Al's favorite interviews. This was with Ed Barbier. He is a professor of economics at Colorado State University, talking about his book, The Water Paradox. That interview originally aired on February 12th, 2019. Thank you for listening to this episode of This Green Earth this week. Chris and Al will be back next week with more This Green Earth. If you have any thoughts, questions, comments, ideas for future shows, you can email Chris and Nell at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. All the interviews for this show and past shows and future shows will be available on KPCW as a podcast. You're listening to KPCW Park City. This has been This Green Earth.